Blog Talk Radio.
World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great, man. Doing real good. How was your week?
Do you have anything you want to declare today?
We're doing our declaration of awesomeness tonight, right?
We're gonna make our own special declaration. We noted last week that we had missed our annual tradition of doing a declaration of singularity show. And I've provided a link over on worldtransform.com to the Speculist blog, one of the reposts of that. I have reposted it faithfully every year. I didn't repost it this year. A piece I did, actually going back 10 years now, when I first posted the Declaration of Singularity. Can you believe it's been that long since we first declared singularity? And basically all it is I took the Declaration of Independence, for those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, took the Declaration of Independence and updated it for the singularity. It's a great framework. The language in the Declaration of Independence is a great framework for setting a marker, you know, for saying, okay, from here on, things are going to be different. So follow that link if you want to read it. I think we've read it in the past. We're not going to take showtime reading it tonight, although it's quite brilliant.
I will go along.
Mr. Thomas Jefferson, but it's fun to see how, with a few tweaks, we can be talking about not a change of one government to another, but a change from one civilization to another, and that's really what the Declaration of Singularity is all about. But I thought tonight we'll take it down a notch. We've missed 4th of July. It's the same week as Bastille Day, so in honor of the French, we'll declare that. We'll declare awesomeness. We'll declare that everything is awesome. And I don't know, Stephen, if we have the audio I asked for. We didn't talk about that before.
Yeah, the everything is awesome music from the Lego Movie. I do not have.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, it was a long shot. But in fact, if we had that, we could just play that riff and that'd be the show, right? There's our declaration, right? Everything is awesome. If you have any questions, send Stephen an email and he'll get back to you. I think that's pretty much
sum it all up.
Pretty much where we are. No, because I think we sometimes lose track. We lose sight of the fact, as Louis C.K. put it quite well a few years ago, and we did a show talking about this. Everything's amazing, and nobody's happy. There's a lot of terrible stuff going on in the world. A lot of things that we should rightly be concerned about. A lot of things we should be worried about. A lot of things that perhaps we should even be alarmed about, but there are some amazing good things going on. And tonight, we're just going to spend some time talking about awesome stuff that's happening in the world. So that's what we do every week anyway, but tonight we're going to do it with a little more self-awareness as to that's what the show's about.
Yeah. Well, Phil, I want to congratulate the guys that sent out that Pluto probe. We've mentioned this last week and how great the pictures were coming back, but it has now done its flyby completely, and it's amazing some of the pictures that have come back. And That's I guess that could be our number one topic, the awesomeness of that, the ninth former planet, the planet that was formerly a planet. But anyway, it's I mean, I guess you've seen some of the pictures that have come out since our last show.
It's astounding. It's absolutely amazing. I had to take my dad to the doctor the other day, and then we were sitting in the car waiting for my mother to do something in the store, and I'm just scrolling through Facebook, and I pull up this picture, and I showed it to my dad, and I said, "Do you know what that is?" And he looks at it and goes, "No, what is that?" And I said, "Those are mountains on Pluto." And we're just both looking at it, and it's just astounding. You know, this planet / dwarf planet that was discovered 2 years after he was born, and now we've sent a spacecraft there. It flew by there, and it's taken, you know, thanks to the technology we have today, it's taken these amazing high-resolution pictures that we're going to – I guess it'll be weeks, days or weeks – to process them all before we see them all. It's an astounding accomplishment. And, you know, one of the things that's really, really cool about it is timing is everything in this life. You know, the craft passed Pluto. It encountered Pluto 50 years to the day after the first Mariner encountered Mars, right? So,
well, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fantastic kind of bookends to our exploration of the solar system. Not that we're done, but to this phase of it, you know. I mean, which began back in the 60s, back before we ever even got to the moon, before a human being had ever set foot on the moon. We had sent our first spacecraft to Mars. And to me, it's really interesting that when people talk about this amazing progress that occurred in the 20th century, which there's no question, it's absolutely astounding, the bookends they like to put on it is from Wright Brothers in 1903 to Neil Armstrong in 1969, which is a fantastic, I mean, unbelievable accomplishment. In 66 years, you went from this rickety wooden thing that flew for a few seconds to people setting foot on the moon. Absolutely incredible accomplishment. But even before we got to the moon, think about this. We sent a spacecraft all the way to Mars, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. And to think less than 100 years after discovering this blip on, you know, on a photographic plate, this little tiny dot of light that was moving in such a way that we could say, yep, that's a planet, or now as we say, dwarf planet. From there, 85 years later, to bringing back these pictures of something so far away that even traveling at, what is it going, 36,000 miles per hour, it took us 9 years to get there. Absolutely astounding accomplishment, and just it's hard to even put it into perspective what an amazing accomplishment that is.
And you know, they had to, you know, obviously to conserve power over that long trip, it was, you know, it was mostly off, wasn't it? I mean, there might have been a couple of systems that were operational during part of that voyage, but it was, and so I mean, the big question is, will it even turn on? And it did, and you know, that to me, that's amazing. You know, just that they were able to time it in such a way as to it came on properly, it booted up and got to work, and you know, it's just amazing. That now I did not know the distances involved until I you know, read an article last week and about, you know, what we're talking about here is Pluto is a golf ball to Earth's basketball. Okay, that's the difference in size. We're a basketball. You know, Earth is a basketball. Pluto is a golf ball. Now,
wow, that's small.
And so how far is this golf ball from the basketball?
Okay, at that scale, that's there. Interesting, right? Here's how we picture. Here's how we picture the solar system, right? I would think if we're a basketball and Pluto's a golf ball, the way I picture the solar system, I would say that the golf ball is probably like from the center of my living room to, say, my neighbor's house across the street, right? Somewhere in their house, or maybe their backyard, right? It's way far away compared to, right? So, is that right?
Yeah, you're just a little off, Phil.
So what's the
now, it varies because the orbit of Pluto, you know, comes in and out from. It's a very, it's not a circular orbit. It's an elliptical orbit, and it varies from at the closest The golf ball.
Oh, it must be more like a mile. It must be more like a mile for that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
At its closest to the basketball, the golf ball is 50 miles away. At its furthest, it's 80 miles away. The golf ball.
Wow. Okay.
So you know, we shot a grain of sand off of our basketball,
right,
to a golf ball that was, you know, probably about 60 miles away. And
right.
It turned on and
in 9 years
it
got there. Yeah. Wow.
That's right. Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
That is completely amazing. That is so cool. Here's the thing I saw on Facebook. I may go on a rant, Stephen, so just rant heads up here.
we have a rant alert, folks.
rant alert. So you know how to mute me if it gets really bad. But my friend John Myers had shared this timeline photo from the White House. Okay, so the White House put the picture, a high-res picture of Pluto with the heart, and it said from the White House, this is, I guess, a tweet or a Facebook share from the White House, America is the first country to reach Pluto, and this is the closest image we've ever seen. It took decades to fly our New Horizons spacecraft through the solar system to send back this love note from the dwarf planet. Congrats on a successful Pluto flyby, NASA. And so, you know, nice little post from the White House. And so someone, you know, one of the top comments was, I don't care which country got there first. I'm glad that I and the rest of humanity were able to see what Pluto looks like in our lifetime. And perhaps I'm adding tone of voice. I apologize. I hope a few hundred grade school children are inspired to dream big, reach beyond the clutches of our planet, and create new ways to physically explore our solar system in their lifetime. Okay, well, good. It balances out. That's a nice comment. And then someone under this wrote, I was thinking the same thing. Literally no one but America cares that they were first.
Literally no one. Well, here's what I have to say about it. So it was 9 years.
And now if you start to rant, I can't mute you, Stephen. So
yeah. Here's my rant. Since it was 9 years in the making, it's Bush's fault. Okay.
I blame George W. Bush. That's a good call.
Anyway.
Well, I think, you know, I wrote this really intense, like, you know, well, does literally no one care that Russia put the first satellite in orbit? I care about that, and I'm not Russia, right? Does literally no one but Russia care that they put the first man in space, the first woman in space? Literally no one but America cares that we put the first man on the moon? I mean, the national competition is one of the things that has driven the space race. And all the ways nations can compete, isn't this the best one? I mean, it's, you know, it's right up there with the Olympics.
It
beats
all
stuff.
To death, doesn't it? I mean,
it's
a much better. It's a much better contest than bullets flying, and that's we were going to compete with the Soviet Union one way or another, and
right.
This was probably, you know, going to the moon, you know, ultimately. The fall of the wall in Berlin many years later, those contests you know, about basically openness versus a closed economy and in the space race, those contests, they were bloodless, and they were instructive too,
and totally
uplifting,
totally good for everybody, right? They were good for everybody involved. I mean, when you think about we normally mark Yuri's night when it passes, right, every year. It's like Yuri Gagarin, first man in space. That is a huge Russian accomplishment, a huge Russian national accomplishment. It's also a huge human accomplishment. And it's like all of humanity honors that, right? I mean, who doesn't think that's a cool thing?
Or they should.
Exactly.
It was another thing on top of Sputnik that scared the crap out of my countrymen, but what?
Historically, it was a very scary thing to the U.S.
But that was a good thing from where we sit now.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
That's what got us to the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
and ultimately, you know what? It's what got us to Pluto. It's why we went to Pluto. Ultimately,
exactly.
It has a lot to do with it. Yeah, I think it does. So, you know, I'm just of a mind that it's like, you know what? These things. Because we talked a while back about, you know, Japanese things they're doing, Chinese things they're doing. These are all great accomplishments. It's okay for, I think, for something to be a source of national pride as well as a big human accomplishment. They don't have to be either or, you know. It's like this is a good thing nation states do. Let's let them have this, right? If America was the first to Pluto, and that makes India think, well, we got to be the first to someplace, and they go launch a spaceship. That's awesome. You know, that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. So okay, good. I didn't rant.
Just a little, Phil, but it's okay. That was a good one.
I said what I needed to say.
It was like, you know, it's like the competition to the moon. Ultimately, it was a good thing that ran. So, all right.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel really good about our trip to to Pluto. And indeed, we are entering an era. We've been in an era for some time now where there's international cooperation. There's competition, but there's also cooperation. The International Space Station is all about cooperation. And we're going to talk about building a village on the moon. That'll be one of our stories we talk about a little bit later. And that's all about international cooperation. So, yeah, you know what? There's room for competition. There's room for cooperation. There's room for it to be a national accomplishment, room for it to be a human accomplishment. You know what? Something this good should just be enjoyed every way it can. That's my final word on Pluto. So congrats to the folks who made it happen, and I look forward to learning more and more about Pluto as we really get in and analyze the data. And then where to next, huh?
Oh, yeah. Our next story, it looks like, Phil, is about artificial intelligence and why it is that it seems to be coming to fruition now as opposed to, you know, many years ago. I'm going to tell you, when I was in college, Phil, when I entered college in 1987, there was this basically, you know, this feeling in the field of computer science that artificial intelligence, we were on the verge of it. It was going to be
right.
Huge, and we were going to see it inside of, you know, if not months, certainly inside of just a few years. And it was followed by, you know, just disappointment after disappointment, to the point that people didn't want to talk about artificial intelligence. At least computer scientists didn't. They let's back up and let's aim for simpler things that we can actually deliver on. And so all of a sudden things, you know, it seems to be a turnaround, and there's some reasons for that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. AI, you know, the strong AI, is one of those technologies that gets that reputation, like nuclear fusion, for being, well, it's 20 years off, and it has been for the last 50 years, right? I mean, it's truly
always 20 years
mainframes when they first started talking about AI.
Yeah.
It's
one of those things that's perpetually 20 years away, and it was one of those things that we, you know, from the very beginning, people like Turing, who was, one of the very pioneering computer scientists, was talking about, well, you know, we need to have a test to see if something really is, you know, self-aware. And so he postulated the thought experiment at that time of the Turing test. And that was at the very dawn of computer science. And it was always just right around the corner, but not really. There's so, you know, turns out that consciousness is a hard problem, and I suspect.
Well, indeed.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we're closing in on consciousness, but we're closing in on something. Okay, we're closing in on a very different kind of world that we live in terms of how we interact with our machines, and in as much as almost everything we do involves interacting with them, we're talking about a big, big shift. I don't know. Have you seen these pictures coming out from Google, the deep learning stuff? These freakish pictures.
I guess I haven't.
Well,
I haven't.
Google deep learning and look for the images, and it's really interesting. It's this. It is this visual way of kind of beginning to understand how machine learning is. It works, right? How it's happening. And that's the thing that is drawing us much closer to a breakthrough in true artificial intelligence than we've ever been before. This story we linked on blogtalkradio.com and over at worldtransform.com, here are 9 reasons AI is happening now. The number one reason is artificial neural networks. And it talks about this kind of resurgence of the idea of neural networks, because there's another one, Stephen. Actually, it's kind of a mini AI, right? An idea that was introduced way back in the 70s or 80s. We're gonna make computers that are, you know, functionally like brains. We're gonna create software neurons, and pretty soon we'll have working brains. Well, it never went anywhere in terms of, you know, creating a true strong AI, and it also didn't have that many applications, to the point where neural networks kind of dropped off as something that people were, you know, building their careers around or publishing around or doing those kinds of things. Then we talked about this a few years ago. Then suddenly it became the thing, right? It's what has enabled Google to do amazing things around classifying images, around classifying text, around basically for the first time really coming to understand data, right? We've got machines now that have achieved this like very primal level of understanding. And that's a huge leap, right? We're not just talking about processing data. We're talking about in some way relating to it in a way that that they never had before. That's what artificial neural networks are enabling. That's what deep learning is enabling. Machine learning is enabling. And computers on their own now are being fed, you know, a whole pile of images, and they're starting to sort them out, right? So it used to be that you would say, well, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to define these features for images, and then we'll give them a bunch of images, and we'll see how well they do at matching them up. Now they say, here's a bunch of images. Tell us what they are, right? And the computers are actually going through, and they're classifying images. This really kind of horrible thing that happened, I guess it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, where one of Google's visual identification software accidentally tagged an African-American as a gorilla, right? Well, this is this huge thing. Oh, no, this is racist software, right? This is terrible. This is a terrible thing. Actually, it's just if you looked, you would see that there are probably several thousand misclassifications of that kind. But the truth is, what it shows is that without being told that gorillas and humans are anything at all alike, right? It was just making the association. It was saying, oh, I think, can't tell for sure. I think that's a gorilla. So it put it in that column. And obviously, the, you know, computer software doesn't have all the racial baggage that we carry around. And so it wasn't thinking about those kinds of things one way or another. But what it shows is that these machines are engaged in unsupervised learning. That's what they call it. It's, you know, they're learning on their own. They're figuring out the relationships on their own, and they're teaching themselves how to be smarter.
If I then go to like the Google images, okay, and I Google the term cat, it's not just returning images that have the word cat as a label in a web page underneath a picture. It's returning a picture that the computer thinks is a cat, regardless.
At least that's what we're working towards. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
What you're seeing happen there ultimately is analogous to what happens when we have a conversation about that. Analogous to if I said, Stephen, go find me a picture of a cat, right? Or if you said that to me.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't have to have functioning that's occurring.
Picture. Yeah, you wouldn't have to have a text underneath it to tell you it's a cat. You just see a picture. Oh, here's a cat.
If I had a bunch of pictures in front of me, I go, well, here's one. This is a cat. Here you go. Does that look like a cat?
Yeah.
Oh, you want a different kind? Here's a green cat or what? You know, whatever it was.
You fancy calico cats? Here, I got three. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, at a very crude and rudimentary level, that's what's happening. That's what's happening now. The computer now has an idea, if we can be so bold as to say that. So we now have computers with ideas. Okay, we have software systems and machines that have an idea about something. And you know, if that doesn't give you just a little bit of a moment of pause, if not a chill, it really should. I mean, to think about what that means and what it applies going forward. But it's not the only thing going on. This story talks about artificial neural networks. It talks about knowledge graph.
Now we have to explain that real quick. That is the fact that we don't start from scratch with every new system that's being tried. What is happening is that, you know, we're building on platforms There's open platforms that you can build on if you're interested in. And we had a guest on the show, Phil, a little while back, who was building his own AI platform.
Our friend Louis Arana, AI, absolutely.
On those platforms.
Louis Arana.
Open platforms. Yeah.
He's cobbled together. What did we say? It was like basically they were. They were building an AI, with a few guys in their living room. But you can do that now because all the parts you need are sitting out there. That's exactly right. The knowledge is already there. So you've got that to build on. That's knowledge graph. Then item three, I think, is as big as any of them, is natural language processing. This is what's going to really create the relationship between us and the machines. The fact that we now talk to them, and even when we're not speaking vocally to them, the idea that we're going to be much more conversational in our interactions with them because they have ideas now, right? We're crossing a threshold where they sort of understand what you're saying in the way that, people sort of understand what you're saying. It's going to make a tremendous difference. Speech processing right up there with natural language processing. You put those two together and you've got a fundamentally different kind of relationship with a machine than you had before. That's the future that Siri has sort of hinted at over the last few years, but that we're really going to be in before too long. The Jarvis future, basically, where we're, chatting with our computer. Go ahead.
The Jarvis in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I've thought of him as an interesting character from the very beginning. But, the point at which I go, yeah, that's what we need to be aiming for, was in the first Avengers movie, where Tony Stark is in a situation where he is, putting his life on the line, and there doesn't appear to be any way that he's going to come back from it. Okay, he's going to sacrifice himself for the city. Okay, and
right.
What does Jarvis do? Jarvis says, "Sir, should I call Pepper?"
Right.
It saw the situation, realized that, Tony is about to die. And what does a person want to do when they're in that situation? They want to talk to their loved one. Right. So he made those connections and then dialed the number. That's what we want. Right. I mean, we want a personal assistant that's going to be that on top of things and know the right thing to do based on the context every single time. And that's, We're not there yet by any means, but that's the goal, I think.
Have you been watching Humans by any chance on AMC?
You encouraged me to last week. I haven't yet.
So when you get to episode three, mild spoiler coming. There's actually is a real interesting story developing about a family that's adopted this robot. Who, is like their domestic servant. She watches the kids, she cleans up, she makes meals, and she's just fantastic everywhere. There's a really tense relationship between the wife/mother and the robot. And one of the reasons that we ultimately find out that she's highly suspicious of the robot is that they're supposed to be programmed to respond to the emotional states of the family members. And at one point, the robot's just too good at it. Right, it's like the robot actually picks up on something and responds in the right way, and it just infuriates the mother, because she's, she feels threatened by the robot. But it's an interesting dynamic.
More in tune with the family than she is.
Yeah, exactly. We want, we think we want systems that are going to do that, but that's going to lead to all kinds of interesting. Interesting complications in our lives when they do, because it's a great example when you talk about Jarvis saying, "Should I call Pepper?" And it's a very interesting example when you see what happened in Humans. I won't say what, because I don't want to spoil the show for anybody who hasn't watched it, but I recommend it highly to anybody who hasn't seen that show. Then they give some other things. They talk about consumer acceptance, ubiquity of personal computing, funding, and research efforts. The bottom line is everything is trending in this direction. We have, in some sense, crossed the Rubicon, or we're crossing the Rubicon right now with artificial intelligence. And what we're going to see over the next 10, 15, 20 years, maybe even the next 5 years, is going to be absolutely phenomenal. If we were still capable of being surprised by things, it would absolutely knock our socks off. The bottom line is, we've talked about this before, Stephen, 5 years from now, we're going to be living in a world where we just casually have conversations with computers all the time. as in-depth as you and I are talking right now, and we'll think nothing of it. And we'll talk about it on the show. We'll go, yeah, remember how we said this was going to happen? Yeah. And here it is.
Well, were we brilliant? Anyway,
well, we will take a moment.
And,
for that,
and the
anyway.
And the and the computer will say yes, you were pretty brilliant. because
exactly.
It'll be in tune with our need for, you know,
it'll be in
little,
tune for how needy
validation.
We are for that kind of
yeah,
validation.
<that's right>. Yeah.
Oh.
Well,
so that's
a
thing to look forward to.
Hey, I got
for sure.
Along these lines of AI, I've got a one particular application of AI is the self-driving cars. And
right.
A story here, Google's self-driving car was involved in a pretty serious accident here recently. Why would that fit into a show about awesomeness? It wasn't the car's fault. It got rear-ended, and it was that's the thing. It's been the Google car these cars have driven, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles now, involved in two
right.
accidents, and were both accidents were the fault of humans around the car, not the car. And that's saying something. These things are driving lots and lots of miles so far with and doing a fantastic job. And so I'm looking forward to having as an option at least my car taking over a little bit every now and then.
It's interesting that you almost need the blip, right? You almost need the exception to help prove the rule, right? To draw attention to how amazing the record has been for these cars.
Exactly. It's one of those things that, you know, if it had literally been no accidents, no mishaps at all, we'd be going, well, you know, that's boring. Well, there've been a couple of accidents, and this one, the second one was pretty bad apparently. But again, it wasn't the, it just goes to show anyone can get rear-ended, even a robot car. So that's the deal there.
There you go. I'm trying to make a good segue to this story about the village on the moon. I can't think of the right way to draw from there to that. I really should have just jumped.
Well, when
right
we have
on
self-driving
it when we were...
cars on the moon, we want someplace to go, right? So there you are.
Exactly. You know, we need a couple villages on the moon, so there's actually
they have,
three.
Well, you go this village,
so it has a choice, right? Take me someplace unexpected, please, Carl. But this is such a cool story. I'm so excited about this. I got to tell you. So we've got this guy, Johann Dietrich Werner. He's the new head of the European Space Agency. And I don't know, Stephen, if you're like me, but every time you read European Space Agency, do you get this kind of feeling like you used to get 25, 30 years ago when you saw like Fox Television Network? You know, was it? It's this. You know, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, they're right up. You know, it's the also ran kind of player in the space, right? Because the space race has always been the U.S. and Russia, right? And Europe's come along and they've
yeah.
done amazing things. Let's give them credit. Landed a space. There you go. You're talking about national pride. The Europeans, a European coalition, landed the first ever spacecraft on a comet just this year, right? Amazing accomplishment that occurred just this year. But I never think of them as the big innovators. I never think of them as the big leaders. I don't think of them as the visionaries in space. And in fact, sadly, anymore, I don't think of anyone as particularly having that role because no one is saying the, okay, we're done with the planets, let's build a starship kind of idea, right? You know, that's what I want to hear from somebody in the space agency business. And what you usually get is a lot of stuff about climate change, a lot of stuff about how important science is, a lot of stuff about why we need to understand the universe, but not how we need to get out into space. So it was just really awesome to read this story about Professor Johann Dietrich Werner, who holds his first interview or press conference, whatever it was, as the head of the European Space Agency, and sets out his thoughts on what needs to happen next. And what he says needs to happen next is, we need to go build a village on the moon. And I'm like, yes, that's the kind of thing that... you know, we need people to be talking about, right? This is, you know, this is a visionary idea. This is a let's get out into space kind of idea. And he says, you know, not just a few houses and a store and a church, but a real thriving community. He wants to put it on the dark side of the moon. I'm not clear why. Maybe he wants to get to the helium-3. But he wants
I think he wants the dark side of the moon because it would be an awesome place for an observatory. You wouldn't have you wouldn't have the Earth reflecting and causing a problem with looking out into space. I think that's the thought there.
There you go. And of course you're going to have some infrastructure on the bright side, so automatically you got two villages on the moon. The way I look at it, the way I would plan.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
And self-driving cars going back and forth. Yes.
Yeah. If you're not going to build a rail line between them, you just put a road up and have the self-driving cars go back and forth between the two. But it just sounds like the kind of ideas people used to toss around in the 50s and 60s, back when we were really getting started in space, back when we were really pushing ahead. And he looks at it as not just an important stepping stone, not just an important place for us to be, but like as a stepping stone for moving farther out into space. You know, it's a proof of concept and an important place for us to be too. So the link is there at the site. I recommend to everyone read it and just think for a while about, well, wouldn't that be cool if we built a village on the moon and that was step one towards going to Mars? I know that there are a lot of reasons, you know, people talk about the moon's not the smartest place to go. You know, there might be more resources elsewhere. Maybe it's better to settle in the asteroid belt. But you know what? I think it's great if we have people arguing about that, right? If there's a serious debate going on as to whether we should build a settlement on the moon or on Mars or out in the asteroid belt or, you know, a cloud city orbiting Venus, that's great, especially if there's an intention to do one of those things, right? Or better yet, an intention to do several of those things. And you go back to the idea of international competition. Wouldn't it be cool if the Europeans said, we're putting a village on the moon, and the Russians would then say, oh yeah, well, we're putting a cloud city on Venus, right? And the Americans said, well, that's it. We've got to put a full colony on Mars, right? I mean, that would be fantastic. The great thing about the European Space Agency, too, is that it's not a nation state. It is a coalition. So it speaks to the fact, as with the International Space Station, that we can do these things cooperatively as well as competitively. And, you know, it would probably take the whole world to get a village on the moon. But if we could all work together and make that happen, who knows what else we might make happen.
And like you said, proof of concept. If we're doing that, and then I think we really need to get good at that sort of thing closer to home before we try Mars. I've often thought that. And you know, we were close, Bill. The thought of a moon base. You know, there were those in the Apollo project that felt that was, you know, Apollo was leading directly to that. We were going to have a moon base by the mid-70s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad we didn't, you know, it, the expense of the project and all that, it was canceled before it could get into all that. But it was I think that was a pretty neat idea that we just didn't quite get there. So let's do it now.
Yeah, let's go for it. I think I'm declaring that we would get a lot of awesomeness out of building a village on the moon, and I'd sure like to go spend a vacation there in my old age. So we need to get that thing going. All right, Steve, what's next?
Okay. I wanted to ask you about this induction cooking thing. What's up with that? Yeah, I see at the link that you've given, there's a half of a pan, and somebody's like cracking an egg, and part of the egg is like leaking out onto the burner itself and not cooking, but the half of the egg that's in the pan is cooking very quickly. So what's happening there?
Yeah, this is just a fantastic demonstration of a technology I had never heard of until I saw this video. Induction cooking is a magnetic process for heating up food. And the way it works is your burner, as shown in the video there, if you see the link at worldtransform.com or at blogtalkradio.com, follow that link and look at the video. The way it works is the burner is not hot. the burner is just emitting an electric field. So in fact, the heating element in an induction heating system is the pan. So you've got a metal pan that you set on this induction unit. It's not really a burner at all, and it starts to generate heat. So they got a great demonstration there. They've taken the pan, they've cut it in half, and as you just described, Stephen, they break an egg into this half a pan. Half the egg goes into the pan, half the egg goes right onto the what you think of as the stovetop surface, the thing that should be, it should cook faster there than on the pan. The egg on the pan stays completely raw. The egg on the burner stays completely raw. The egg in the pan immediately starts to cook. And this is how this works. The metal implement used for cooking that is drawing that magnetic field, that is being drawn on by that magnetic field in an induction system, is actually where all the heat occurs. And they say in the, if you read the article, once you lift that pan off there and touch the stove, it doesn't feel hot. You know, it's picked up maybe a little bit of heat from having that hot pan sitting there, but it's not hot itself. So it's cool just because of how weird that is, you know, from our expectations. You think about, wow, what if your stove worked that way, right? You turn the burner all the way up on high, put your hand on it, a minute later, no heat whatsoever. Put a pot on it with some hot water, and it starts to boil almost immediately, right? What a strange thing. But what's cool about it is not just how fast it is, but how efficient it is. This is actually a much more energy-efficient way of cooking, and I wouldn't be surprised if we won't see stoves working this way probably in the fairly near future. It will require special cookware, but you know, based on the results, I think that will probably be worth getting the cookware just to have a stove that's, you know, that cool and that safe, right? The only thing you have now to worry about is
my question is the advantage. Is the advantage felt to be safety? Because, you know, if you, as long as you don't have a pan on the stove, there's nothing hot there that you can burn yourself on. Now, obviously, you can still burn yourself if you were to put your hand on the pan.
Right.
It would, you know, you would scald your hand pretty bad. Like that, your hand would be like that cooking egg. But if you put your hand on what we think of as the burner, which is no longer a burner, but, you know, a magnetic generator, you won't be burned or at all. So
it's like one less thing to burn yourself on in the kitchen, and the one less thing is the thing that most people end up burning themselves on if they're going to burn themselves in the kitchen. I suppose
if you move the pan off of there, you know, there, even if you were to leave it on, unlike a burner, there's no danger of like a house fire or anything, because you left your burner on or your magnetic induction thing.
Exactly.
Because there's no pan on there. There's no pan on there.
Right. So, presumably there's danger that, you know, a paperclip might stick to it or something like that, right? But there's no danger that you're going to have a fire. So if electricity is safer than gas, this is the next step of safety after electricity. This is the safest way of all, and apparently much more energy efficient than traditional electric stove too. So you know, I think it's very cool. I hope we see these at some point. I'd sure like to give it a try.
That's pretty awesome. That is pretty awesome. Okay, we got the next story here, Phil, is about Alzheimer's treatments. What's happening here?
Oh, we doing that one? I was gonna slip in the.
I'm sorry.
One.
I get out of order.
That's okay. I like the Alzheimer's one too. That's pretty exciting. New Alzheimer's treatment fully restores memory function. Now, we've read about some pretty interesting developments around Alzheimer's treatments in mice over the last couple of years anyway. But I think this one, you know, if the headline isn't just misleading us, shows us how far this has come. Fully restoring memory function of the mice that received the treatment, 75% got their memory function back. So it fully restores memory for 3/4 of the patients, again, mice, that were subjected to the treatment. Well, this is an incredibly exciting thing, and you think about how far we have come with talking about this. A few years ago, they were talking about Alzheimer's treatment that just, you know, that stopped the damage, were big breakthroughs, right? I mean, it's like, boy, if we could just if we could just, you know,
we could just hold what we got and not lose any more.
Get to stasis. Yeah, catch it early and hold what we've got. That would be amazing. Here we're talking about, you know, this is a non-invasive technology using ultrasound that gets rid of these amyloid plaques, this junk that collects in the brain that actually causes the external effects of Alzheimer's that we see, right? The behavioral effects of Alzheimer's. So it's like one of the saddest things really about Alzheimer's, when you come to realize that that's what's going on, this plaque is forming on the brain, is that the person is still there, right? All the knowledge is still there, everything you need to constitute the personality that you know and love is still there, and it's being blocked by this stuff. Well, what they're doing is they're shooting ultrasound into the brain, breaking that stuff off, and lo and behold, the person comes back, right? You think of Alzheimer's as being this degenerative thing where, you know, the individual is lost, and for sure, from a subjective standpoint, what we experience of that individual is lost, and what they're able to do is lost functionally, from a capability standpoint. But the person's really still there. And this, you know, this is potentially a demonstration of how we can start getting people back from Alzheimer's, not just mitigating the damage, not just preventing it from getting worse, but actually taking people who are far gone with Alzheimer's. I mean, picture this, Stephen, people who, you know, have been essentially written off, and maybe in a year or two, or it might be a little farther down the road, you shoot some ultrasound into their brain, and suddenly the lights come back on. And, you know,
sounds
if
like
that's
the protagonist.
Not awesome, what's your definition of awesome, right?
I'm all on this awesome. This is great. From a personal standpoint, having had a grandfather that went through this, and I mean, you know, being told, by the doctors of that day, which was the 1980s, okay, that, you know, it's degenerative. There's no coming back. It just gets worse and worse. There's no upside, you know, there's no, you know, and to have this is amazing. And, I'm extremely, this touches me on a personal level because of that experience with my grandfather. But it's, I'm reminded also of the protagonist in the near future science fiction novel Rainbow's End. Have you ever? It's a Werner Vinge novel about a time that's basically they're on the verge of the singularity, but not quite there. The protagonist, the main person, is someone that's been far gone and basically sitting in the nursing home with Alzheimer's or something for several years, and he is slowly brought back and rejuvenated and everything with various therapies. And I mean, he's up and going as like a full participating member of society by the time that, you get into the main events of the book. And I when I read that, I said, man, we need this. And here's perhaps a piece of the of that puzzle, and you know, exciting, awesome, yeah.
It really is. I mean, I didn't know where you're going with that when you said it reminded you of the story. I was thinking maybe of like Flowers for Algernon, which is a little bit like that, but it's you're right, absolutely, you've nailed it. It's a lot more like what occurs there in Rainbow's End. So once again, Werner Vinge gives us a little glimpse into the world that we're that we're rapidly sliding into. What is so exciting to me about this is it just demonstrates how quickly, potentially, we are sliding into a world where things that we've just taken for granted as, you know, unfortunate realities of life can be once and for all put aside. We're not there yet. You know, we're just talking about a very promising experiment with some mice. Before we get too excited. But if it pans out, or if an approach like this does pan out, this is a way of putting, a way of like getting years of life back for so many people. And essentially, this is life extension, right? because, you know, one of the things we talk about when we talk about what's the point of extending human life, what we really want to extend is human vitality. What we really want to extend is the period of time that people spend enjoying their lives, interacting with their loved ones, you know, contributing in some way, being here with us, right? And that's what
You constantly hear the arguments against things like life extension are, you know, well, I don't want to extend that period of time that I'm in the nursing home. Well, that's not what, you know, that's not what we're talking about, is it? Or, you know, no one wants to extend decrepitude. And here's the secret. It would be practically impossible to extend decrepitude because it is a risky way to live. You can't, you know, you will eventually, that will kill you. So what do? We want to combat that and come back from it. And that's a really, really neat story. I've got a something that kind of is a companion story in a way. It's completely different sort of brain treatment that's being developed by university researchers at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and also the University of Illinois at Urbana. These researchers are working on implantable devices. Now, the treatment you were talking about is completely non-invasive, and that's awesome. You know, it's just ultrasound, you know, the same thing that shows us babies inside of a woman is, it also could be used as a, for treatment of the brain. Well, this is invasive. What we're talking about is an implantable device, that is capable of delivering light to, particular neurons to activate certain parts of the brain. And also to give targeted drug therapy to certain parts of the brain. And they're calling it the wireless optofluidic neural probe. It's the width of a human hair that can be implanted in the brain and triggered by remote control. And
how does light deliver medicine? I don't understand.
Well, it's two different systems on the same probe, okay? One thing is, you know, light is stimulating certain neurons, but it also, that same probe, can deliver, you know, actual medicine to targeted regions of the brain. If you need, you know, if you need something there, then it's able to deliver it because it is there. And it's been demonstrated for in mice, and it may be, you know, they think it'll be used to treat people in chronic pain. Who have depression or epilepsy or other neurological disorders. And so, completely different kind of therapy than what you were talking about, Phil. But, you know, hey, let's let them all battle it out. We'll go with the one that's...
we'll take one of those. Well, again, this only worked in 75% of the mice, right? So you got 25% potentially.
The 25% might need this, yeah. So,
who needs something else? Plus, it sounds like, you know, with the capability of delivering medication, I mean, this is a really exciting technology. It sounds totally.
Hey, they got a cool picture here. You know, it's one. You know, it's got a little scale of 1 millimeter, so it looks like a little, looks like a hair coming down to like a little drop. Okay, and the drop is 1 millimeter wide. Okay, now the drop part of it is a liquid drug reservoir, and on top of that little drop is an LED, and so it's lighted, you know, and that light is, you know, you target that neurons, and oh well, that's not getting it done. Let's shoot a little liquid medicine in there and see if that helps. And oh yeah, good, we got the result we want. That's a pretty neat little device there, and so more awesomeness.
Very cool. I look forward to probably having one of these lights shine to my brain here in the not too distant future. So we'll see how that goes. Okay,
a literal light bulb. Yeah, the light bulb, you know, over your head when you have an idea.
Talking about a light coming on inside. More, exactly.
Yeah, it's a little more literal now after this. So.
Absolutely.
Great.
Okay. Well, here's one I didn't include in the show description, but I saw this and I thought this was so cool. It's in Ars Technica, and I will add the link. The headline is electric vehicle batteries are getting cheaper, much faster, than we expected. And they're talking about a kind of battery called the Li-ion battery, the Li-ion battery. And I'll just read the, I know we're running close on our timer, so I'll jump right to the big news here. The truly surprising part of Tesla's Powerwall announcement was its price point. In 2014, the average cost of installing a stationary, I guess it's Li-ion battery in a California home was $23,429, according to the Wall Street Journal. In May, Tesla CEO Elon Musk said that these batteries would start at $3,500 plus a $500 installation cost. So we're talking about, you know, what about a factor of six by which the price of these very powerful, very capable batteries has dropped. And we're seeing some real momentum around progress with batteries. And batteries, of course, has been one of those technologies that we've looked to as, well, it solves so many problems if we just had better batteries, right? Electric cars, it's a hassle because, you know, you got to keep recharging that battery, you know. Being on or off the grid, solar power, so many things are reliant ultimately on the ability to store energy in a compact way, have it be there reliably, have it keep its charge, and it be something that you can keep using for a long time. And it appears that this Li-ion technology is, if not the ultimate way to go, it's a big stepping stone in the right direction. These are incredibly powerful batteries. People are going to be using them to, as it says in the story, run their homes. You can run your car off them, and they've dropped in price, you know, in 1 year by a factor of six. So I'm looking forward to seeing how rapidly can batteries become more powerful, how rapidly will the price continue to plummet, and, you know, what does all that say about a lot of different, you know, possible ways of powering our vehicles, of powering our homes, and just basically what our energy future looks like. Batteries are a big part of it, and we're seeing some really cool developments there.
Well, you know, some of the best ways of harvesting clean energy are, you don't get it all day long. Solar, you only get it when the sun shines. Wind, you only get it when the wind blows. Those are completely green, very little impact on the environment by comparison to other ways of getting our energy. But, hey, you know, what are you going to do when those things aren't happening? You need batteries, and you need really good batteries. And, these things power our green future, not just with powering our own homes and everything, but also, you know, if we're rolling down the highway with electric cars, we need really good batteries that hold a lot of energy by comparison to the weight that they cost us. So, batteries are a huge part of our future. And, the better they get, the more we can, these visions of our future can be achieved. So, yeah, awesome stuff there.
And what's cool is, like with what we see happening with certain medical technologies, like we see happening with artificial intelligence, these things are happening so gradually. They're not covered as big news stories, but slowly but surely, huge things are emerging in medical technology and artificial intelligence. You know, everything we've talked about tonight is the stuff that's kind of been sneaking up on us. And batteries is, I think, going to be another one where a decade or so from now, maybe two decades from now, just in terms of how we access energy, how we get around, things are going to be very different, and batteries will play a big part in it. And we'll look back and I don't know, it'll be hard to remember what a hassle they used to be, right? Because things are going to be so much better in the very near future. And I declare batteries and the progress that's being made to them awesome. All right, and with that, Stephen, I have to say, with just a couple minutes left, what's our music?
Our music is Alive by Doc Aquatic.
Alive by Doc Aquatic?
Arrived. The self-driving car has, I have arrived in my self-driving car.
Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us. Just a reminder, we're going to be off for a couple weeks. I'm going to be traveling internationally. I don't think we're going to get a show in probably before the second week of August. So everyone enjoy your summer, and we'll be with you again soon. But until that time, live to see it.